Light beer, dark money. Agree on something. Politics, culture, and the intersection of faith, freedom, and free enterprise. And now, live from the Star Worldwide Network studios, here are your hosts, Light Beer Chris Clements and Dark Money Sean Noble.
Welcome back to another episode of Light Beer Dark Money. I'm Sean Noble.
And I'm a very tired Chris Clements.
Yeah, you've been tired lately.
I have been. I was on the road last week, and I'm no longer the road warrior I used to be.
You used to be quite the road warrior.
I was gone for a couple days every single week for 23 years.
And then this time
I was gone for 3 days last week, and I was toast.
Well,
so I'm really grateful just to be sitting here.
Yeah, well, we're grateful to have you. But we're more grateful to have Phil Kirpin.
We have
American Commitment as our guest today. Phil is the president of American Commitment. Before that, he was the policy director at Americans for Prosperity. Phil, you've been at American Commitment, what, since 2010,
you hired me.
2010.
That's interesting. You know, half the interviews I do, people introduce me as the president and founder, and I stopped correcting them because explaining how you were the founder, but then sort of handed it over. It's not worth the effort. So I just let them give me the false accolades of being the founder.
Even I forgot that I was the founder of American Commitment.
We call that COVID brain right now.
Well, it's in part because Phil has done such a great job.
Yeah.
He has become an institution in DC as far as the policy center. There is literally, I tell this to people outside of the Beltway all the time and inside the Beltway when they listen, when they don't listen to me, but the smartest policy person in Washington, D.C. is Phil Kirpin.
Yeah.
Period. And, full stop. And
that's like being the giant in the land of midgets. I appreciate that. Let's remember the bones of D.C. is set very low.
Don't let anybody from, AEI know that. They might steal them.
Well,
you can just be in this big room of cubicles with a bunch of other so-called thinkers.
AEI is great, but Phil has been just a force of nature. And anyone who follows, if you don't follow Phil on Twitter, it's at Kirpin. He has been, during COVID, he was the center of the universe on information about that. To the point where Alex Berenson was relying on Phil's tweets for information. Phil, I don't know how you do it because the amount of information that you compile and analyze and put out is just. I know you sleep maybe a little bit. You've got kids and you're at home every night to put them to bed, but
it's a lot, especially because it's interesting. I don't know. A month before COVID hit, Steve Moore asked me to start doing some work for him at Committee to Unleash Prosperity also. So I thought it was going to be like this easy side thing. And then, we ended up, when COVID hit, we launched this daily newsletter. So now I have spent a few hours every day on that. And I thought it would be for a week or two, and it's been 2.5 years and counting. And so it's a lot. And by the way, if people want to get that, it's totally free. CommitteeToUnleashProsperity.com. I do it with Steve Moore and John Fund. And it started as all COVID, and now it's mostly other things, taxes and spending, inflation, energy, but there's still some COVID in there. I would say that COVID became, but the thing is, Sean, the thing about COVID kind of taking everything over from sort of a mindshare standpoint is nothing else was happening. It's not like we were also having lots of other big policy fights.
Good point.
We were having some, but they mostly all related to COVID, like COVID relief spending or whatever. So, if you're sort of committed to doing, free market advocacy, it's hard to care as much as you usually do about, taxes and spending and regulation when the government is like literally ordering businesses to shut down.
Yeah.
So it had to take priority.
Great point. Well, and thank goodness that you were there because, anytime I had a question, I just went to Phil's Twitter feed.
Yeah.
Because the answers were there. I mean, it might be a couple days ago and, you know, 100 texts or tweets ago, but, you know, it was there. Phil,
well,
what...
Well, the beauty of that is that they kept him on Twitter, even though he was probably tweeting some controversial things. Did you ever get banned?
One time I got locked out of my account. One time it was for like a weekend. And I freaked out because I'm like an addict. I can't. And then when they turned it back on, they said it was they said my account was compromised and they disabled it for my protection or whatever. So who knows if that really happened or what. But
right. Because
they never like admittedly said, you said things we don't like, so we're shutting you down. I never got one of those.
Because Alex Berenson is still off of Twitter.
No, he's on.
Oh, he's back on.
He's back on. He won a legal settlement from that.
Because he won the lawsuit. Okay, great.
Yeah. So, Phil, speaking of COVID news today, I'm just going to let you describe it because you're better at this.
Yeah, they want our kids to get the jab. That's basically the thing.
CDC has something called ACIP or ACIP, which is the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. And they set the schedule of recommended childhood vaccines. And they voted to add the COVID vaccine to that schedule. And in a number of states, that's going to almost certainly result in mandates. I don't think there are any states that do it automatically, but there are a lot of states that traditionally, when something's on the schedule, they do mandate it for school. And so it'll be interesting to watch whether that happens and in how many places that happens. The HPV vaccine was added to the schedule, you might remember, 10 or 15 years ago, and it was very controversial, and very few states actually did mandate it, even though it was on the schedule. So it's not an automatic thing. But I think based on everything we saw in COVID with the masks and the school shutdowns and the other kind of stuff, whatever the CDC recommended tended to get adopted and turned into a mandate. And then when people, you know, the CDC would say, we don't mandate, we only issue guidance. And then the schools would say, well, of course we have to follow CDC. What do you want us to do? And they just sort of both point the finger at each other. And parents were extraordinarily frustrated. So we'll see if that happens. For the under age five, vaccine uptake has been very, very low. It's only about 7% that have even had one dose. And I think it's 2.5% that have had the complete series. So there's almost no interest in the baby vax. It's a little bit higher for the age 5 to 11. It's about 38% that had one dose and 32% that had, you know, the full series. But you're still basically talking about 2/3 of younger kids that, you know, if there is a mandate, they're going to be out of compliance with that mandate, at least on a national basis. Obviously, there's some variation by state. I don't think that we're going to get a lot of mandates. I think that the most liberal places, we probably will have this. But I think this is more than anything about liability, because the liability protection that the vaccines have right now is under something called the countermeasures, immunity vaccine. You know, I'm forgetting what the C stands for, but it's the CICP, which is part of the PREP Act, and it's related to the national emergency. And so, if they didn't put it on the schedule, it would have lost its immunity, liability protection, when the national emergency ends. And they've extended it to January. I don't think they were ever going to let it end if they didn't first do this move. Putting it on the schedule means it qualifies for something called the VICP, the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. The other one's the Countermeasure Injury Compensation Program. So now they can end the national emergency without opening the vaccine manufacturers up to lawsuits, because anything that's on the schedule of childhood vaccines, you can't sue. You can only apply to the VICP for compensation if you're injured. And so I think that was probably the motivation for this. But it does mean that we're almost certainly going to have a bunch of fights in a bunch of places about, you know, your kid has to get it. It's on the schedule. It's recommended. Right. And so we're going to mandate it, whether it's at the school level or the state level or the local government level. And so I think this is, it's an opportunity, I think, for Republican politicians who are smart to say, it's never going to happen on my watch. And I think, you know, the race where it might make a difference is New York State, where Lee Zeldin came out right away and said, if I'm governor, this will never be mandated. And I think pretty much everyone thinks that if Hochul's governor, it will be mandated. Right. So that's one where it really is on the line, on the ballot. And of course, you know, the Republican candidates in Arizona are saying they wouldn't mandate it. But, you know, I have some doubts whether a Democrat would try it there either. It would be pretty stupid.
Yeah, there would be serious backlash here for sure.
Well, I mean, Katie Hobbs, who knows? I mean, well, so far she hasn't disappointed.
I think it's pretty. I mean, you know, we're still, you know, just under 3 weeks away from the election, but I think it's pretty safe at this point. I'm comfortable to say.
You're comfortable. The great prognosticator.
The Katie Hobbs is not going to be the next governor of Arizona.
Well, I mean, she what happened yesterday? 6,000 ballots were improperly sent to...
10,000, they said.
Was it 10,000? I saw six, and then I'm like, you can't make this up. I mean, even if you tried.
All right.
You know, yeah. For the Secretary of State's office.
My favorite Katie Hobbs soundbite that I saw yesterday, she said that she was asked about the you know, the ESA expansion, and she said something along the lines of, well, some kids are just always going to be stuck in failing schools.
Let's just give up.
Because we like it that way.
Yeah.
You know?
That's unbelievable.
Oh, my goodness. So why do you think... there's not been enough discussion when we're talking about kids, we're talking about COVID. There's some different data points of, you know, the vast majority of kids have either have gotten COVID and either have known about it, about 90%. Why are we still not talking about the efficacy of natural immunity when it comes to children?
Oh, it's nonsense. It's ridiculous. Now, there was actually a really good paper by a Danish scientist, I don't know, probably at least a year ago now, where she made the argument, I think pretty compellingly, that even if you had a great vaccine, one that didn't wane, didn't have any of the problems of the vaccines we have, it wouldn't make sense to vaccinate kids because you want children to be exposed to viruses when they're young and they've got a great strong immune system, and then every couple of years thereafter, because then it won't be dangerous for them in the rest of their life. They'll be used to having seen it over and over. And that is probably a more effective mechanism and certainly a much less costly mechanism than doing, you know, shot after shot on an annual basis or whatever it is. And so I think it's to me, it makes no sense, especially, you know, you look at like the presentation that the CDC people went through today when they had this vote. There was no mention of the fact that their own data says 90% of kids have already had it. None.
Wow.
So I think it's ridiculous that this is going on right now with where we are. And, you know, most everyone is pretty much, you know, you ask them what they think of COVID and they'll talk about it in the past tense. They didn't talk about it in the future tense. People are ready to move on. And yet, you know, the CDC is still fighting this battle to, you know, kind of forcibly vaccinate kids. I think it's crazy because if they've already had the virus, okay, you're not talking about the risk of the virus versus the risk of the vaccine. You're talking about just the risk of the vaccine for no reason.
Right, for no reason. And there is a risk.
And that's where Republicans, conservatives can really, really hammer away at. Is that one data point of 90% of kids who've had COVID? It's like, why would we use a vaccine that is still relatively experimental on our kids, what, to prove a point?
I'm not one of these people that say it should be pulled from the market or something like that. If you want to use it, that, you know, that's your decision as a parent. That's fine. I mean, I'm not going to do it to my kids, but if someone wants to, you know, that's fine. But the mandates are where it gets really scary really quickly.
And, yeah.
As I said, I think I'm pleased that so many Republicans seem to have jumped on this right away because it means they actually see there's an opportunity. Maybe they've done their polling and their focus groups.
Well, it puts the D's on defense almost immediately. They don't have a real answer for
as they should be, but based on how crazy this has been. I mean,
denying the science. Remember?
Yeah.
Remember when Fauci said, "I am the science."
The science
dictates it that if you've had COVID, then you have natural immunity.
Right.
That's what the science dictates.
Yeah.
So follow it.
So, Phil, coming off a little bit off of COVID, what, you know, I think it's pretty well certain that the House is going to go Republican. I'm feeling a little bit bullish about the Senate right now. I think that the Senate probably goes Republican. What, as a policy expert and as a guy who's been in D.C. and watched this stuff and been a part of this policy debate for years, what should be the priorities that Republicans look at going into next year with a majority in the House and potentially a majority in the Senate?
Well, I think that you can't ignore what happened the last couple of years. You've got to confront it and deal with it in a couple of ways. I think they should create a sort of a citizens audit committee or commission where they take people from outside the public health establishment who have, you know, expertise in mathematics and, you know, other relevant fields to basically look at all the stuff that came out of CDC and NIH and to audit it and figure out what went wrong in so many ways and kind of produce a report with some recommendations and findings. I think that would be really helpful. The other thing that I'd really like to see is there should be legislation modeled on the Hatch Act that, excuse me, prohibits any government employee from directing any private sector entity to censor or suppress First Amendment protected speech. Because one of the worst things that's happened over the last couple of years is that the government basically dragoons the social media companies into being their censors, and they say certain things are misinformation and people get banned, they get censored, they get blocked, they get shadow banned, all this kind of stuff. And all of that was really being directed, I believe, by government employees, which raises serious First Amendment issues. But, you know, it's hard to win a First Amendment lawsuit. It would be much better if they passed a law that specifically individually prohibits that for all government employees. And I think that's the, you know, there are a lot of issues related to sort of, you know, tech regulation and censorship and Section 230 and antitrust that really divide Republicans. This should be something that should totally, every Republican should be able to vote for that bill. So I would have that pretty high on the agenda. You know, let the, your government should fix itself first on, you know, when it comes to this issue. So I would have that very high on the agenda. But, you know, I those are the two main things kind of in terms of the dealing with what went wrong in COVID is having that kind of audit commission and dealing with the censorship issue. But then, you know, we need an economic agenda. I mean, look, we've got some major, major economic problems. The only thing this administration does is throw more and more money at everything. They're even trying to basically illegally spend another $500 billion on the student loan bailout, and we'll see what the courts do on that. But you know, I think that you know, we've got to have an aggressive, pro-energy, deregulatory, fiscal responsibility agenda. We've got to significantly reduce the amount of federal spending, or you know, at least freeze it, so we don't have another one of these massive inflationary increases. And we've got to address the regulatory environment. And of course, you know, it's very hard to do anything in Congress when the president's of the other party, because it's hard to override vetoes. And I just hope that they've got, you know, that they've got the guts to fight on these things, even if it means, you know, that the president is vetoing appropriations bills and maybe of shutdowns or other things. But they've got to really, I think, be willing to fight. And I also think on sort of the cultural issues, they have to be willing to fight. And in particular, on some of the gender craziness, which I think is motivating a lot of our base right now, they need to deliver something substantive. I mean, we've got an Office of Civil Rights in HHS right now that says that it's a violation of federal civil rights laws to not provide so-called gender affirming care. So I think they should take that on. They should go to the mat to fight that. I mean, there are a lot of things that have been hot button issues. They've got to figure out a way to deliver on some of them, I think, if they're going to kind of win the confidence and keep people excited and engaged into the next presidential.
Yeah, totally agree.
Do you think, I mean, if Kevin McCarthy is indeed speaker, do you think he has the moxie, for lack of a better word, to not squish on those issues? Can he keep everyone together and move forward?
The thing about McCarthy is he's very political, okay? And when somebody's very political, they don't have strong policy convictions. And so that makes him not like, you know, that makes him not like us. And so, you know, it's easy to say, you know, he's going to be a square. But, you know, the other half of that is if you can make the case to him that it's good politics to do these things, then he'll do them. And I think we can make that case. And so it's really, I think, about framing things in a way that they're going to be popular and they're going to be, you know, wins that you want to have with people in the broad middle. And the benefit that we have is the left has really moved itself way outside the mainstream on everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got opportunities, I think, to pick off some of the things that they're craziest on and target those for, you know, legislative action, kind of dare the president to use vetoes.
Yeah. What I notice in the background, you've got your Mets banner on. So Phil is probably
he's in pain like we are.
He is as much of a Mets fan as I am a Dodgers fan. Maybe even more.
They each won one postseason.
That's right.
The Braves also won one postseason game.
That was one of the worst Saturdays I've had in a long time. Yeah. USC lost, and then I turned that off, and I watched the Dodgers just lose in crazy fashion.
You know, the postseason's a total crapshoot. The Dodgers have been the best team for, 10 years now, and they won one World Series.
Right.
Well, and this year they had the best record in history.
I know.
It's a very, you know, and the thing about baseball is that, you know, over a long season, the best teams definitely differentiate themselves. But in a 3 or 5 game series, it's who's hot.
Yep.
And so, you know, that's kind of the fun of the postseason. But it's also extraordinarily frustrating when you have kind of a special team and they're really good and they're doing things. And then they're cold come playoff time, then it's over in a heartbeat. So, you know, I will say that the Mets were so bad under their previous ownership, so dysfunctional, that the prospects of a team that can at least have a shot every year is kind of a positive going forward. So I try to look at it that way. It was obviously a letdown how the season ended, but you know, the Mets haven't had a lot of 100-win seasons. I think that's only their third ever. So they gave us a lot of good moments in the regular season.
Right. Right.
Man, now, that is a positive outlook.
Yeah. Well, you know, he is.
Well, people keep coming up. I almost threw my. I'm so sorry about your man. I'm like, I'm a Mets fan. I've been through a lot worse. You know, like,
yeah. This is an easy season.
I almost threw my remote at my TV the other night. I mean, Phil, I just couldn't believe it.
How did you become a Mets fan versus a Yankees fan?
Well, I had the good/bad fortune of being a little kid in the 80s when the Mets were good and the Yankees were bad. And in particular, you know, I was 7 years old in 1986. So that was like, you know, which is still the highlight, obviously, of my baseball fandom was age 7. Right. But, you know, New York was definitely a National League town at that time. And they were, you know, obviously a great, great team. And what I didn't necessarily know as a little kid was that was highly aberrational.
Yeah, because you weren't quite old enough. You weren't as old as I was to watch the Yankees of the 70s kind of dominate, right?
That was a baby. Completely. Didn't see those.
Yeah. Yeah. What, so as you look at the, well, just a real quick question and a timely topical question. You think this news out of Iowa about Grassley being potentially in trouble in his reelect is real?
You know, 89 years old is old,
yep.
But it's Iowa, which is a state that's trending very Republican, and it's a Republican year. So I can't see him actually losing, especially because the governor's going to be reelected by 15 or 20 points. And so it's hard to see. It's hard to see him actually losing in this environment. But, you know, sometimes in a big wave year, you get that big shocking surprise on the other side that sort of no one paid attention to. So it's not impossible. But I just think given the year and the tilt of the state, I don't think it's going to happen. But you could certainly say that maybe he's going for one too many terms.
Right. Well, I think part of why it's competitive when it probably shouldn't be is that every time there's any news, anything in the news about Biden's health or age, that automatically hurts Grassley.
Because he's like 10 years older. So.
Yeah, because he's older. I mean, he's got his faculties are definitely more intact, but he's 10 years older.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
But he's not acting the same.
No, but...
he certainly is not saying the same, well, you know, incomprehensible thing.
Part of why he'll probably end up winning.
Yeah, but Grassley's, he's the guy, he'll put in the work to do what he has to do to win. I mean, he's not like Dick Lugar or somebody who's basically sitting in D.C. I mean, he goes to all 99 counties every single year.
Yeah.
He's doing that.
And he tweets. And it's hilarious.
He writes the craziest tweets about how much he hates the crazy stuff on History Channel and why don't they have real history.
I loved it when he hit a deer. He tweeted about hitting a deer. That was hilarious.
Well, but also he and Senator Johnson from Wisconsin, who was also was in a tight race, you know, been some of the most critical and vicious going after the president and his family.
They've been really good on oversight.
They've been fantastic, really, and they've gone after Hunter Biden. They released a report shortly before the last election, and I want to say it was like in July. And it was immensely critical of the president and his ties to China and his ties to other places in the world. And the president has been going after him.
Yeah. It's really interesting because you've got a few senators that you know are going to be really aggressive on oversight on all kinds of stuff, including, you know, not just Hunter Biden stuff, but all the COVID related stuff, just all kinds of things. Ron Johnson certainly leading that. Rand Paul, I would put in that category, and Chuck Grassley as well. What's kind of interesting is that I don't really see that in the House. I mean, I think that James Comer's in line to chair oversight. I'm not even sure. And what does it tell you that I'm not even sure who's in line to chair oversight? Yeah, I mean, they're not really talking about how they're going to use the oversight powers and the investigatory powers on the House side. And, you know, maybe that doesn't matter too much if Republicans win both. But if Republicans only win the House, they're really going to have to lead on all that stuff. And, you know, maybe they've got good plans to do that. But I haven't seen much from a public standpoint.
Interesting.
Well, that goes back to Speaker McCarthy, if he is indeed Speaker. You know, he can put people in there that actually were that's a priority, or he makes it a priority as a virtue of his speakership.
You make it sound like there's a question about whether he's going to be Speaker.
I think that there's a question. I mean, I think he's done a great job. There's a great article in The Federalist today about him. And there's the fact that he's thread this middle road of both the Trump, the Trump wing of the Republican Party, the Freedom Caucus, and then mainstream Republicans. And he's done a great job of bouncing back from when he pulled himself out of the speakership before for personal reasons, which is not mentioned in the article. And I just think it's still, you know, Republicans have an amazing ability to screw it up. And and certainly won't if they have the majority. To your point, they have the opportunity to really screw it up versus, you know, seeing what the landscapes that it's in front of them and acting upon that.
Well, that's the big wild card. I mean, it was the affair accusations that kept them from getting it last time. Was that pretextual? Did people just push those because they didn't want him in the seat for some other reason, or was that an actual genuine, like, he's a bad guy because he had an affair, so he shouldn't be Speaker. I haven't heard anything about any more recent, allegations or accusations or anything like that. But, you know, if somebody wants to take him out and they pop up whatever an accusation, whatever it is, it's just a numbers game. It just becomes a numbers question at that point. And depending on how big the majority is, you could have, you know, sometimes a pretty small group of people that don't even necessarily support someone else, but they can block you from getting a majority. And so it's never a certainty in my mind whether someone can get that vote until they've got the votes locked up. But I think that the House majority is going to be pretty substantial. So I don't think it's going to be a situation where a small group can block someone.
Yeah.
Well, here's a quote from the article. The senior House Freedom Caucus source says, McCarthy has played his cards well, quote unquote, but adds, I don't think anybody thinks Trump is in love with Kevin. He goes on to say, I just don't think there'll be anything organized until after the election, the source adds. The idea that it's done and dusted, they say, I think is ridiculous.
So, well, they're always going to say that. I mean, there's always going to be the rabble rousers,
you know. So, but I think the big question is Kevin McCarthy going to act like an establishment Republican? Is he going to squish on a lot of these issues that you've outlined, or is he willing to, you know, they make a baseball analogy in the article? Is he willing to bust a few heads and actually do the things that need to get done?
I think we're going to see a lot more power in the committees than we have in the last few Congresses. I think one of the conditions on, you know, for instance, I think that Jim Jordan's going to get the judiciary chair, and he's going to have control of the purview of all the subject matter that's in the purview of that committee. And I think there are going to be some other committee chairs similarly. They're going to have, you know, real control over their committee and not just rubber stamping bills that are written in the speaker's office and sort of, it dropped into the world fully formed. And so, if the committee process is actually functioning and if the work and the bills are really coming out of the committee, then the speaker's role is more of a kind of a traffic cop role of figuring out when things come to the floor and so forth, instead of kind of the be-all, end-all king of the place, which is how, you know, it's been run under Pelosi. And so if, you know, ideally, he won't have to do the heavy lifting himself it'll come in the committee.
Yeah, they mentioned that as well in the article about Jim Jordan and the closeness the bond they've bridged over since he was up for Speaker last time, and then also the talk about how Pelosi has completely destroyed the House of Representatives. I mean, in terms of any sort of working relationships, comedy.
Well, half of them don't even show up.
Yeah,
just right. Send their proxy letter.
And rebuilding what the House should be. you know, the people's house.
It's going to take some time.
Opening it up back to the people, you know.
Yeah, and it would be nice if you don't have to, didn't have to be escorted by a staffer.
Exactly. You know, and being able to bring people back to the people's house is something that's going to be quite the challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. What, so you made a good point, an interesting point about the oversight on the Senate side being, if assuming that Republicans take the Senate, because Grassley and Johnson have been very instrumental in that. I do think that the oversight needs to be aggressive, but I also worry that there's going to be a push to go too far. Like, there's going to be articles of impeachment for a dozen administration officials, and I think that that's counterproductive. What do you think, Phil?
You could certainly make the case that, you know, Mayorkas's refusal to enforce the border is a high crime. You could certainly make the case that Cardona spending $500 billion on student loan bailouts is a high crime. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's, I think that one thing we should have learned from the two Trump impeachments is, if we didn't already know it before that from Clinton, is that impeachment is fundamentally a political exercise.
Yeah.
And therefore, I mean, you shouldn't do it unless it's your advantage politically.
Right.
Especially
right.
Because, you know, you're not going to get convictions in the Senate. And so, you know, it's, you know, unless the polling and the focus groups and so forth show that it's actually beneficial, I don't see why they would do it. And, you know, I think that that may be a situation where having someone who's highly political as the House Speaker is a good thing, because I don't know if we're going to get any impeachments of cabinet officials or not, but I'm pretty confident that we're not going to do it unless it's good politics.
Yeah.
How many cabinet officials do you think, let's say for the sake of argument, House goes Republican, Senate switches as well, how many cabinet secretaries do you think resign?
You know, there's usually a shuffle. There's usually a shuffle. There's usually a shuffle after 2 years, regardless. But especially if it's an election that goes badly for the incumbent party, I think you'll probably see three or four of them leave, something like that. And then you'll have more trickle out after that.
You got to think Mayorkas is. He's got his papers ready.
He can't be enjoying himself.
No. You got to think. November 9th, he walks into the Oval Office and just hands his resignation.
Yeah.
It's not going to be fun for him.
Give us your sense on whether Biden actually runs for reelection.
Oh, goodness.
I don't think so. I mean, I think his wife will want him to, but I hear she's
running.
Well, maybe. I mean, I think his numbers are going to be really bad. I don't see a big bounce back coming, but, you know, you never know. I think if he thinks... The conventional wisdom is he'll run if Trump is running and he won't run if Trump isn't. So I don't know. I think people really hate politicians. I think they would be smart to find a non-politician is what I think.
Who would be on their short list? Because I look at their bench and
well,
it's pretty
I think
bad.
Sheryl Sandberg,
well,
I think
they had Tulsi Gabbard, but she left.
I think Sheryl Sandberg wants to run. I think someone like Mark Cuban could be a good candidate. I think their default non-Biden candidate's Newsom, but I don't think he's a great candidate. So I don't know.
He's got great hair.
That's about it. That does usually work.
With a lot of pomade. So
that's
interesting.
About it, yeah.
But I look at it as one of those instances where you look at the Democrat bench and you look at the Republican bench, and my goodness, the Republican bench looks significantly better than the Democrat bench,
the thing about the Republican side is there are a lot of people who look good, but in reality, I think if Trump runs, it's Trump, and if he doesn't, it's DeSantis. I don't think anyone else really can beat either of those two guys, but you know, it's a long way off. We'll see.
I think that's a pretty, I would tend to agree with that.
Yeah, I would too. Yeah, I don't.
As much as I don't want to. I just want Trump to not run.
Well, I think I'll put it this way. Trump is telling everyone he's running, but he would say that whether he's running or not.
Yeah, exactly.
So you can take no information from the fact that
he's been
exactly
saying that since the 1980s.
Yeah, so. Exactly. You know, I don't know. I keep hearing that, you know, with his business being what it is and his family situation being what it is, that he's not running. But he's trying to raise as much money as he can.
So he's raising a lot of money.
And he's done that.
Definitely that. Phil, where can people, well, we've already talked, Twitter is probably the best way, right? At Kirpin?
Yeah, I'm an addict. So yeah, get my up to the second thoughts on everything.
Well, I will highly recommend that everyone watch Phil Kirpin, because if you want to know what's going on in DC and where, you know, Phil's the person who's looking around the corner more than anybody else I know. So following Phil will get you on the inside on the policy and the politics better than about anybody. So
that's high. Phil, that's high praise, Phil. That is that.
I was gonna say, I call Sean to ask what's happening.
You know, he could even remember that he hired you.
Yeah, right.
I mean, or that he founded the organization. So that's You know, that's where COVID is with our brains these days.
I'm just saying that he's made it so much his own, and it's just such an institution. It's been great.
That's fantastic,
Phil. We really appreciate taking time. We know it's a sacrifice for you with as busy as you are. Not only with what you do on the policy and politics, but because you've got a young family that Phil, I will say, Phil is an amazing father.
Hmm.
He is home every evening to put the kids to bed.
That's awesome. Good for you.
That's something that I can't say.
That and that's a hard thing to do in D.C.
Yeah,
you know, with everything that's happening. I know that for a fact.
It is, although it got easier in the last couple of years because everyone canceled all their plans.
Yeah.
They're back now for the most part.
Right.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Phil, for being on the show.
All right, guys. Have a good one.
Right, take care. God bless.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for listening.